Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, doing deep prajna paramita, clearly saw emptiness of all the five conditions, thus completely relieving misfortune and pain. Of course, Avalokiteshvara isn't somewhere else, someone else. This Bodhisattva that you are, to say doing prajna paramita, doing deep prajna paramita. Maybe that's okay to say, but in a way that's this zazening, this just sitting, if we use that word. Because prajna paramita is another name for your life. Deep, shallow, good, better, great. These words we like to use, and we believe they distinguish something, but then we miss the prajna that our life is. If we believe the adjectives and the deep and shallow, the great and small, even saying doing makes us think there's something special to do. Yes, we need to say zazening. We need to say doing zazen. But we need to remember zazen is just sitting, is just being this moment, is just this life that we are from the very beginning. This mind is Buddha. But if we think this mind is something in particular, much less Buddha, something in particular, we get ourselves into trouble. So, still, it's important to know that our zazen is the zazen of just this. If you want to use other terms, we could use the traditional Theravadan shamatha and vipassana. So shamatha is like samadhi, the samadhi of just sitting, the samadhi of being, experiencing, and not and something else, but the other side of that, or I shouldn't even say other side, it's not even another side, is the insight, the vipassana, the prajna, is the clearly seeing emptiness of all the five conditions. Spelling it out that way, we need to be careful. But still, from our experiential side, there is seeing and not seeing. There is not any difference of emptiness. There isn't more emptiness, less emptiness, but experientially, though we can say seeing. We could say clearly seeing. We could say dimly seeing. We could say being, doing, prajna. And yet we need to be careful that we don't believe that we do prajna. Prajna does us. Sitting sits us. And yet we can resist it. We can resist it in all sorts of ways. Therefore, the Heart Sutra continues to clarify. No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, no. So on and so forth. All the different ways where we refuse, resist, cover over who and what we are. Cover it over with beliefs and thoughts and tendencies, all sorts. We could sum them up in a way that the Heart Sutra does further on, where we say, no hindrance and therefore no fear. Hindrance or hindrances, if we call it that way, can arise in all sorts of ways. They can arise inside and outside. They, of course, are hindrances only when we believe them or hold on to them or bump into them or are sure they must be dealt with, and they're the truth of what so-called we are or so-called other people are. Then, in the midst of no hindrance, we discover ourselves hindered. We discover ourselves believing that somehow life is not okay, or this aspect of life is not okay, whether this aspect is some other person or myself or this circumstance and this thing they said or did or didn't do. So right there is our practice realm of zazening, of being deep prajna that sees clearly, if I explain it, the emptiness, the ongoing changing of this moment condition, this rather than the story that we create about it, and the story that we build, whether so-called consciously or unconsciously, the stories and beliefs that we entangle in. Often they're quite visceral, and they arise and we only see the little tip of them at the end, maybe, if we see it at all. If we notice at all that we're entangled and hindered, and or we might notice it when we notice fear. We might notice the fear only after we've noticed the beliefs, or after we've, if I'll use the expression, sat with it for a while, we might notice, oh, I'm terrified when she says that to me, when that's occurring. Or we might not notice the fear. Nevertheless, the Heart Sutra reminds us, no hindrance, and yet we're hindered. So right there's practice. No hindrance and therefore no fear. And yet we discover viscerally in thoughts, in feelings, in all sorts of ways, fear. Whatever we call it, whatever ways we notice it, whatever so-called pasts are the cause, or so-called future projections, are the beliefs. Even so-called genetic, biological, psychological, social, etc., tendencies that we have, when someone says, we're all of a sudden find our whole body reacting, tensing, shaking, whatever, when something happens. In some sense, there's something we could even temporarily call a fear PTSD that occurs. We could imagine it in those terms. Where the trauma comes from the PT, post-traumatic, doesn't matter. We don't have to figure it out. We don't have to go searching for it. But we can notice that conditions arise and all of a sudden there's fear if we're present for it. Sometimes we don't notice that. Instead, we notice our reactions to it, whether anger or sadness. So despite no hindrance, therefore no fear, we need to be this prajna practice, this zazening, which is in a sense the combination of the samadhi, the experiencing presence, if we say it that way, and the clearly seeing. Even though sometimes we emphasize an effort in one side or in the other, both of them are necessary. And if we only emphasize one, if we only attend to one and look for, oh, I need to have this kind of experience for it to be good zazen, we put out our eye and don't see, then that kind of even deep sitting becomes useless because it doesn't extend, it doesn't include the clear seeing of emptiness, if I say it that way. Of course, there's no such thing as emptiness. Emptiness is exactly form. Form is exactly emptiness. Form is exactly form. Emptiness is exactly emptiness. But we need to see it for ourselves. Otherwise, despite the fact that someone can say, this very life, this Buddha, we really need to cover the mouth completely before we hear that. Wash our ears out from believing that. Run away, because otherwise it becomes another hindrance. So, and yet, this is exactly our practice. No hindrance, therefore no fear. And in the midst of no hindrance, no fear, making, seeing, when practice effort is needed because of the arising hindrance, being sensitive to noticing what we believe, are believing as hindrance, when fear is there, if you can, simply, I shouldn't say simply, bodily, viscerally embodying this fear, that's the exact perfect antidote for fear PTSD. And yet, it's often so difficult for us to do it. The very nature of fear is that we, I shouldn't say very nature of it, but an aspect of it is that we will do anything to get away from it, rather than to be this fear. You don't have to go looking for fear. No one. You don't need any fear. Of course, we always face this life-death moment. Always that fear can arise from the very nature of being human. But maybe that I could talk about tomorrow. Otherwise, I don't have anything else to say. But you don't have to go create fear. Some people are what's called fear junkies. They love the adrenaline high, and they go create situations where they can get to feel that. But then they use it to further entangle and further enlarge and enhance their self-centeredness. And then the rest of life is sort of jumped over. Always right here. Dull, boring, wonderful. Plain, ordinary, bring it on. Fearful, so be it. That's just sitting, just zazening, just this very moment being Buddha, this very moment being embodying, being zazening, being fear. Being fear is no fear, no hindrance. Or resisting fear is exactly being fear. If being resisting, if that's so. No hindrance, therefore no fear. No fear, thus the Bodhisattva lives Prajnaparamita with no hindrance in mind. Right here is Nirvana. So, that's enough for this morning, this afternoon, for me talking. Maybe we can say something more about this. So I'll stop now. You're all very familiar with the Heart Sutra since you recite it, chant it, do it, be it regularly. And the Heart Sutra is simply articulating what's so. It's the heart, the essence, if we want to say it, of this prajna wisdom that you are. It's not something added. It's articulating what and who you are, articulating what our practices. But our practice isn't adding something on. It's just being who we are, not being hindered. Not being hindered by what we add on. Not adding on, but even when adding on, embrace what's added on and be not hindered by what's added on. See clearly that even adding on is nothing but the emptiness of all the aspects, the five conditions of how and what you add on, which is nothing but this very life, Buddha, that you are. Okay, I'll stop now. And you might have something to say, or ask, or bring up. If you wish, please change your position. Okay. One, I think he's just scratching his head.
Okay. You mentioned PTSD, and I remember recently I heard a discussion about PTSD and treatment for it and recent developments in that, and a particular treatment that seems to be sometimes successful for extreme cases involve working with a person, a therapist or a counselor working with a person, and sometimes with the aid of a psychotropic drug like ecstasy or another one, the person is guided in a sense back to the original trauma, and if the person is able to, in a way, re-experience the original trauma, the PTSD can be relieved or resolved. And the person said it's not for everybody because some people just cannot do that. It's too difficult. And, you know, we're not talking about that with our practice, but we are talking about, in a way, re-experiencing just the fear bodily. And that's the doorway. That's the way.
Yes. I'd be careful, but I'll talk about that tomorrow, about this re-experiencing in terms of our story about the past, where it came from. In one sense, our very life is, you could say, all sorts of cause and effect that come together now, that we don't have to figure out where did this fear reaction to that come from. I mean, we could say, you know, there's genetic causes, there's historical causes, we can say this happened, fine. Some of them you might be able to even trace because I was there, is there, and this and that. But it's all this moment. And in this moment, how it comes up, what's important, what's valuable, is to be this experiencing, if you want to say, be in the midst of the entangling reactions, which is what the PTSD is, to the extent that you can, and as you say, some people can't, because it's too painful, too difficult, but to whatever extent you can, to be the body-mind experiencing, if I explain it in that way. Our tendency is to want to figure out where and what and isolate it. But the whole of life is the opportunity to be the experiencing of life, death, fear, this moment. And, or even just a little hint of it because someone else said something nasty about me right now. Or I remembered that yesterday they dissed me, and that rage that arises because of that, I have to strike out. And instead of that, how do we be even in that, on that simple level? So, in one sense, what you say is very good. But I think it applies to all of us. And we all see it when anger arises, when greed arises, when confusion arises. All of those, we can sometimes sense a little edge, a finger, or even more of the fear that's manifesting as that. I don't say go look for the fear. You don't have to go look for fear. Fear occurs when it occurs. It's always whatever form our attachment, entanglement arises, is the form, is the moment when we get to practice with it. It doesn't make a difference if it's simple emotion thoughts that are just flitting through and we like to play with, or it's this terror that I feel because I heard a noise outside and I believe something, or because I have a memory of someone dying, or I have a memory of myself being in this terrifying situation. of all sorts of variations in between. See, in a sense, you could say greed and anger and confusions, which are called the three poisons, are a reaction, a PTSD-type reaction, to the fundamental ongoing changing impermanence that is our life, that we don't want to face. So in one sense, the Heart Sutra deals with all that and then works down to no hindrance, therefore no fear. Doesn't matter which direction you come from at this stuff. And there's lots of ways of doing it.
When we talk about this, we tend to focus on adversive feelings. But happiness is even more insidious because we don't repel from it and we can try to keep replicating it and set that as the thing we want all the time as opposed and judge, evaluate it against what has happened. And we don't even, when it goes our way, we often don't even see it.
Yes.
But it's the same entangled. Identical entanglement.
Yes.
I have a friend who's went to Mexico this winter, like 5 weeks, met this woman, wonderful, did the things that you do in Mexico when you meet women, I guess, and now is planning his whole life around that happening again next year. He's going to take more time. He's not going to play golf anymore on Friday because he's got to save up his vacation time. He's in a big brawl with his family about coming back for a wedding in Christmas because I'm not coming back for a wedding because I'm going to be out there with, I don't remember her name. And it's like, you just think you're going to cook it up again because, and you don't see now, if it had been terrible, sometimes it's an advantage when it's terrible because we notice it. It's not sublime. It is shocking and physically difficult. But happiness and bliss and whatever you want to call it is really often comes under the radar.
That's true. In some sense, we call that addiction.
Yes.
And especially if it's an addiction to it being a certain way. What if the next time he's with her after 3 days, he says, I'm stuck here for a month.
Go anywhere, you know that.
But, there's nothing wrong with happiness.
No.
If we search out only certain kinds of happiness, then we miss the rest of our life. When I get ice cream, it's okay, but the rest of the day, it's terrible. And it's got to be only this kind of ice cream, only this flavor, and only this temperature. And what if they run out? And what if I run out of money? In one sense, third ancestor starts, the perfect way knows no difficulty, only doesn't get caught by likes and dislikes, preferences and losses, all sorts of ways. It's fine when you like the ice cream, enjoy it. When you like your trip, you had a wonderful trip to Mexico, great. Now, how about having a wonderful time in Chicago while you're working? You could put the trip to Mexico, but on your next year's calendar. But who knows what's going to happen with you, the universe, and everything else. So if we run after likes, it's just as much a trouble as running away from dislikes. So, yeah. we can make trouble for ourselves if we demand that conditions be a certain way. Even when we get them, as you say. Because then what's happening in the rest of his life? And because things are always changing, the high that he got from yesterday might not be replicated in the high that he thinks he's going to get today.
It's almost guaranteed. I mean, you think it's you who's going next year. You are going to be there. Problem number one.
Yes.
You're not going to be there.
And you're going to keep comparing yesterday, last year, to this year, and next year to last year, etc.
Some remembrance of last year, which gets very easily edited. But
yeah. If you like what you get, be that. If you don't like what you get, be that. And both times see what's skillful. As we know, there are all kinds of addictions that start off with very pleasant experiences. Even if they're pleasant because they're a result of the cessation of all sorts of pains that are otherwise there, or all sorts of discomforts, or all sorts of distractions. But if we then hold on to those, if we then even try to replicate a zazen, I had such a wonderful zazen. Wow, I was so high. I knew everything. And we try to replicate it in the next period. What happened? Where is it? I'm not in deep samadhi now. How come my mind's going this way and that? People get to even be addicted to samadhi bliss of different sorts. And then add on all sorts of stories about what those mean and what's the cause of those and how I have to have those and how I'm better because I have those and others don't, etc., etc. That's exactly where practice and clear practice comes in.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Well, I'm sitting here and I'm noticing that I'm starting to get a little annoyed.
Good. What are you annoyed at?
I feel like this is very judgmental. Who cares? The guy is happy going there. He has his fantasy. That's his life. It feels very judgmental to me all of a sudden. I know I'm not supposed to feel that way, but...
No, you could feel...
You know, and I do that too sometimes. I think,
right.
Oh, you know, I'll make this plan and it feels good, but I still live my life every day.
Right. It's not judgment. I'm not attempting to judge him, but I am pointing out that if we get entangled in that happiness remembrance, then we create trouble because we miss our life at the present moment. If we're completely aiming, at least that's about what's going to be next year, then we miss the present moment of our life. Then we say, the only time is good is when I'm in Mexico with this woman. And the rest of my year is just focused on that. The only time is good is when when I have this specific food, wine, experience. Only when I'm climbing rocks is it good. But when I'm walking down the street, that's bad. It's not that he's doing anything wrong, but that there's consequences of living in that way that are inherently problematic. Inherently problematic. Because he misses he misses the rest of his life. Because he believes that the certain sets of conditions and feelings are what makes life okay. So it's not a matter of judgment that he's bad for doing this, but that there's consequences for this. So in a sense, yes, you could say, if you are saying that being entangling in thoughts and anger and greed has consequences of suffering and pain, you could say, yes, that's judgmental. You could, if you want to say it in that way, that's judgmental. I would say that that's a description of what's so. So, call it judgmental, that's fine, but I don't see that your problem with it, and if you want to elaborate on it, please do. It's okay to be judgmental, but if we're caught up in our judgmentalness, because his friend is always talking about Mexico, you get angry with him about that.
By the way, yeah.
Well, but see, that's our
problem. Yeah, I know, but enough of Mexico.
Well, but, you know, if he wants to always talk about Mexico and he's not interested in hearing anything else about it, fine. Then you either decide to be with him or you decide, well, you know, I'll go with him to lunch once a week, but I'm not going to do more than once a week of it because I don't want to hear Mexico anymore.
Or you can just notice that every time he brings it up, you're irritated.
You can do that as long as you know that you can skillfully work with that irritation. As opposed, sometimes you could say, well, you know what, if I'm going to be there with him, I'll get irritated and I'll do things that I regret.
Right.
I don't want to tell him that I've had enough of Mexico. Don't tell me anymore about it, because he'll only get upset, and then we'll have a fight about it. So if he wants to talk about Mexico all the time, great. But then you can say, well, it's skillful for me to only go to lunch with him once a week. You know, it's fine if he wants to talk about Mexico all the time. It's fine if he even goes to Mexico next year and comes back and is really down because it wasn't as great as it was the year before. And then you could be with him. You don't have to tell him anything, but you could be with him so that part of being with people is being with them when they're sad without having to feed what entangles them, but at the same time offers support without trying to teach them anything or anything like that. It's just simply sharing their sadness by being with them. That's a great gift. It doesn't say that Bodhisattva clearly sees the emptiness of all conditions and goes around pointing it out to everyone. Now, unfortunately, you're all here a captive audience. And unfortunately, I have this responsibility to But it could be a fine line between how do we see and not add on judgment, either about ourselves or about others. Because we could judge ourselves. We could say, oh, not again. I thought I had this taken care of. Why am I so caught up in this? Or why did I react so that way? You know, why did I react? I saw it last time. I knew it wasn't a good thing to do. And still, when I met him in the hall, he started saying something. I said, no more Mexico, no more Mexico. Stop it. But I had figured it out. I wasn't going to do that. And then I did it. Because reactiveness is an entangling habit that occurs sometimes almost of itself. As you know, you're sitting Zazen. And all of a sudden, something passes. Just like the cars that pass, something passes in this body-mind moment of your life, whether it's about the guy talking about Mexico or about something else. And all of a sudden you're feeling sad or you're feeling angry or you keep thinking, oh, I gotta fix it. I know there's something wrong. How come I did it again? Or that right there. At some point when we notice the reactiveness, we don't have to then give ourselves a score. Oh, that was a 50. I only caught it, you know, or that was a 60. We don't, or at least notice if we add that judgment onto ourselves. How come I got caught in that again? Judgments occur. They're just another habit. And it's not always so easy to see the difference of going towards judgment or noticing thought without holding on to a judgment about thoughts arising, about being entangled in thoughts, about seeing something.
What will happen is Steve Spring will go to Mexico again and have even a better time than last year and come back and really drive Steve crazy.
Doesn't take much.
I think it can be a distraction, though. You know, that's all I guess. I mean, you started off by talking about, you know, reciting the Heart Sutra, and it, you know, to me, I mean, I think an underlying point. I certainly agree with how easy it can be for us to miss our lives. For myself, at least, I can see that. So I'm not trying to be judgmental back, but I just notice how easy it can be for me to distract myself with these stories about how somebody else should be or, you know, how I should be. Uh-huh. And I thought what you were really, I thought the underlying point was to be, you use the word fear, you don't have to go looking for fear, because even sometimes just sitting and being with whatever is, even in like a sashin, that those things can come up. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, the value is to be able to let those things go, if you will, or I'll just say it that way.
In a way, being fear is being no fear, if I say it that way. Fear is still our story about what this is. It's not that fear is a problem. Fear is a natural aspect of being human. If we are embodied, fear arises, except when it doesn't. But when fear arises, our practice, in a sense, is being the fear, embodying the fear. I mean, that's what, if we take the Heart Sutra as the model, we see we could say, fear is exactly no fear. No fear is exactly fear. In place of fear is exactly emptiness. Emptiness is exactly fear. So it's not a matter of trying to get rid of the fear, but to see and be the emptiness of the fear, so that fear, like everything else, arises and passes when it does. And in a sense, having the capacity to, I'll say the word, be it, or to tolerate the fear without being overwhelmed by fearfulness, or without being entangled and entrapped by the fearing belief reaction, so that we can see, be the emptiness. It's not no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, no form, etc., etc. No hindrance and therefore no fear. If we believe no fear as something other than fear, then we're still trapped in this polarity of fear and this other place where no fear arises. This other thing called no fear. Fear is exactly no fear. No fear is exactly fear. Therefore, the bodhisattva can relieve suffering when fear arises and when no fear arises. That's the ability to, in a sense, embrace this moment as it is, as it's embodied in this body, mind, life moment that we have, that we are. So, that's, nirvana is not somewhere else, or as sometimes we say, samsara is exactly nirvana. Nirvana is exactly samsara. One, two. Okay.
It kind of seems like what you're saying just now relates to what Jeff was talking about with PTSD.
Uh-huh.
Maybe not, but I guess it seems sometimes that I don't know how to say this exactly, but if I'm afraid of something, there's a way of working with that where I would just try to convince myself or somehow set up conditions to demonstrate to myself that that thing was not, I didn't need to be afraid of it.
Okay.
But what it sounds like the Heart Sutra is saying, that's not what the Heart Sutra is saying. The Heart Sutra is saying, or what I heard you say just now, is that that very fear, in experiencing that, just the physicality of it, the actual experience, not all the thoughts about what if this happens, what if that happens, that is the no hindrance.
Yeah, and it's not just physicality, but it's the all the ways of being human. That's why it's broken up into five skandhas in the heart. It's the whole of being human is being just sitting, or just this mind, or just this all conditions emptiness, which enables us to embrace and be this condition. When fear comes, being fear. When life comes, being life. When death comes, being death.
Well, I guess I focus on physicality because
yes,
it seems like a lot of times what I notice is the thinking, the fearful thoughts about, oh no, this is going to happen, oh no, that's going to happen. That's where my attention gets drawn to or stuck
right
on, and the actual experience is
yes
very I'm not even secondary, but it's way beyond secondary.
Right. And the physicality is a good focus of entrance, so to speak, into being this moment, into just sitting or zazening or whatever way we want to say it. It's part of the of this gets to be sometimes both a conceptual and a verbal problem, because we like to deal in duality. So it's body, mind, as if it's two things. So when you say this very mind is Buddha, you say, oh, there's this thing called Buddha that's other than, or this thing called mind, but that's separate from body. And that's a human tendency. Different cultures do it in their own way. but we create problems. And the same with the five skandhas. There really aren't five skandhas, but we can talk about five skandhas. So we talk about them in that way. There isn't a thing called body separate from the thing called mind. And so sometimes we say mind, sometimes we say body, mind. It's fine. Any of them are fine. But yes. And to see what's skillful as the practice entranceway or practice emphasis or support that enables us to be exactly who we are, to be this moment, which is beyond the words that we have about it. Then, even if all about going to Mexico next year, as long as each step in Chicago today is right here can include the thought, I'm going to Mexico next year, and who knows what'll be. But it's right here, this step, on the hard concrete, in the cold wind with snow in Chicago, or whatever other story. Is that okay? Lisa?
I think you just answered this a couple of minutes ago, but I can't seem to understand. What I was going to ask was, what is the relationship or what's the connection between the visceral experience of fear and emptiness? I know the visceral experience of fear, but I don't understand how that's...
Okay. First, we have to be careful. As soon as we say emptiness, we should wash our mouth out and wash our ears out, because we get ideas of what that is. So if I explain it, I'll say emptiness means empty of any fixed, permanent, separate nature, self. So in the sense that visceral fear arises, as long as we don't get caught up in the belief that this is terrible and this is separate from the rest of my life and this is bad and it's different from when I don't feel fear and all the other ways, as long as we see it's simply the arising passing of this very moment, no big deal. But our tendency is to say this fear is something I shouldn't have to tolerate. It's something that means there's something wrong with me or wrong with this condition. Or it's etc., etc. Now that doesn't take away from us it being painful. Pain is part of being born. If you're born, you're lucky if you get to have old age and sickness and death and pain. But if you're born, part of being born means that there's going to be times that the human body will be in pain. That comes with being embodied, so to speak. And part of being embodied means that fear arises. Whether we say it's a big fear, like of sickness and death, or someone that we love being sick and in pain and dying, or whether it's small fears that I won't get any ice cream when I get to the end of the line, they'll be all out of ice cream, or they'll be all out of the chocolate ice cream, which is the only one that's acceptable to me. So we could have small, little, tiny fears or so-called big ones, but they'll arise. But if we see them for what they are, then it's just another moment of this universe manifesting right now, right now. Another moment, if to use that poem that you like, of the true name of this universe. That the poem, that this is a poem by Thich Nhat Hanh, is talks about fear. And people experiencing fear, and he keeps emphasizing, call me by my true name. Even fear, call by the true name. Even being in such visceral fear, pain, that one kills oneself, call by true name. Or abuses and harms others in terrible ways, or even kills others. What's the true name of that? That's what we're talking about here. So if you use the word, want to use the word emptiness, fine.
I don't want to use it. Use it over and over and over and over and over and over and over constantly.
Okay. So I'll just switch it to true name. But don't get trapped by the words. As they say, if someone says, Buddha, you should wash your mouth out and run away. And if... cover your ears and
but it just seems emptiness is always so emphasized. So
well,
it's
an antidote. See emptiness as a antidote, as a clarifying insight which frees us from the conditions that we usually cling to. If we can see it clearly, then the conditions we cling to that create suffering for us and others, we can release. So it's, but emptiness is empty of emptiness. Then use it or don't use it. You don't want to, fine. Any words you hear, throw them away after they're used. It's like a dirty piece of toilet paper. You don't have to carry it around afterwards. But the dirty piece of toilet paper is nothing but Buddha. Even a clean piece of toilet paper is Buddha. Thank you all.